The traditional American campus could be characterized as a hybrid of city and garden, and the particular characteristics of city and the particular characteristics of garden have a lot to do with the kinds of variations that one might encounter in this kind of hybridization. For example, if one were to consider perhaps one of the greatest versions of this hybrid, it would be something like the University of Virginia. And it was conceived of, obviously, by Thomas Jefferson, and with a kind of clear sense of what this campus was to embody. His version of city was based on a kind of neoclassical ideal, which embodied notions of humanism and the Enlightenment. And the version of landscape was related, a kind of terraced, controlled landscape in the midst of a kind of larger, husbanded, agrarian, kind of idealized landscape. At Cornell, it was quite different, though. The earliest buildings at Cornell seem to have been based on a kind of industrial model. They embellished, but nevertheless, they're flexible, they're simple, kind of linear, almost like mill buildings, which isn't consistent with some of the impulses of the Ezra Cornell himself. And the landscape was an animated landscape formed by the glacier with, you know, rolling hills and a kind of linear gash through the landscape that created a kind of significant kind of regional basin. The first three buildings, in almost a kind of obvious way, tended to be built in an alignment. They tended to be built along a kind of ridge line in an alignment and parallel to the kind of path of the glacier, so that there seemed to be this kind of obvious organization of aligned buildings aligning with the length of the lake and aligning with the western horizon, something really not terribly innovative and relatively obvious. The net effect, however, was that the buildings that were used, because they were built as individual objects in a line, created a kind of boundary between this kind of larger landscape, the glacial basin, a kind of landscape room, and a near landscape, which ultimately became at Cornell the Arts Quad, a kind of outdoor living room loosely formed by a series of buildings that encircled the space. So these three buildings started to, as they developed, created a kind of threshold between a near landscape and a distant landscape. And because of their loose arrangement, there was always this dialogue between the two. So the gaps between the buildings became critical. While the three buildings made a line, known as Stone Row, along a ridge, parallel to a distant ridge, the perforations made a series of intersections across that line. And even within the buildings, there are a series of doorways which created a micro set of perforations. So this idea of threshold, that is boundary, and in a sense a ritual boundary, a boundary which could distinguish between the life in the village below and the academic life above, between the west and the east, between the larger landscape and the near landscape. These intersections, these transitions became critical. Question then was, after the first three buildings, what happens? Some very interesting developments occur. Perhaps the most interesting, one of the most interesting, after the first three, is Urist Library. And Urist Library is a really innovative building, because while it maintains the kind of linearity of this stone row in one dimension, it incorporates within its fabric intersections. The primary reading rooms in Urist Library are like the gaps between the stone row buildings. They're major volumes, major spaces, which move across this ridgeline and the buildings which reinforce it. They move from east to west, west to east. So within the building, one could have this experience of near landscape and distant landscape. One could liken it to taking one of the gaps between stone row and putting a roof on it. So in a sense, it became this kind of evolution of the idea, clarifying it in some sense. The architect Miller, William Henry Miller, basically turned a corner, both literally and phenomenally and conceptually in terms of how this campus might be understood. The Cornell campus was, in more than a sense, very real, very really, it was an evolutionary project, unlike the University of Virginia. But each of the practitioners involved over time had a deep sense and sensitivity to what had initially happened with those first three buildings and how those buildings mediated between landscape and artifice. Yeah. Then, at some point, in the 1960s, there was a proposal to build a building near Stone Row, which would have occupied one of those critical voids, those voids that are so important to this whole idea of campus. And one can only imagine that the architect who was approached, in this case it was I.M. Payne Associates, and I believe the partner in charge was a man named John Sullivan, a Cornell graduate. When he was approached, one can only imagine, and this is fiction, pure fiction, but it's probably not entirely implausible that John Sullivan and I.M. Payne might have approached the Cornell fathers and said, no, please, don't ask us to build a building there. The gaps between buildings in this context are critical to the sense of campus, to the accomplishment of the kind of campus that Cornell is. Can't we just reconsider this location? Now, one might have imagined that the Cornell fathers might have said something like, the donor wants it here, and if you aren't up to the task, we can hire, well, fill in the blank. One can, again, only imagine that the response was, okay, all right, we'll do what we can. And the net result was the Johnson Museum. The Johnson Museum has been, for decades, regarded as an acontextual building, one that neglects the context with it. It seems to be inarticulate. It's made of materials which don't relate to the original stone materials. It doesn't have a mansard roof. People have argued that it's out of scale, that it competes with the clock tower. But in a very real sense, it is quintessentially contextual because it is a building which is simultaneously a building and a gap. Not only does this building maintain that capacity to frame the near and distant, it actually builds on the idea. It becomes a collector of landscapes. As you move into it, as you move up and through it, it creates a series of framed engagements between the near and the distant until, at the top of the building, it gives us a kind of perspective that is otherwise impossible without this kind of elevation. It's not clear whether, in fact, there was a grand idea for this merging of landscape and artifice in the earliest iterations of the Cornell campus. People might say, well, that wasn't intended. Maybe, maybe not. What I think was amazing was that in the midst of something which, again, might have been an early pragmatic, not necessarily grand vision, through evolution and through the kind of sensitivity of one generation after another, one of America's most distinguished campuses evolved to be what it is today.